The talk tonight is about the end of waiting. Thomas Jefferson once said, "He who would give up his freedom for security is unworthy of neither." Conditioned into the mind, whether we like it or not, are perceptions of security. Some of these came through our family, our bloodline, so to speak. Some of these we pick up in our education, our culture. Perceptions, ideas of security. And at times we can be living in a way where we're trying to achieve these or have these experiences of security, not always realizing that what's feeding it is conditioning. Also, we can have perceptions that are conditioned into us about success, what success is, and how to go about it, and what life will be like when you have it. Again, often conditioned into the mind through the family system, through the education, the culture, and obviously very much now through the media, advertising, and the worldwide connectedness of communication. Also added to that, notions, perceptions of happiness and fulfillment, sometimes associated with security and success, sometimes not in a direct way. But often there's a linkage. This usually starts when we're very little, when we're very open, we're very innocent, and other people just tell us things, communicate things to us, and we have nothing really to contrast it with, and so it just goes in. He who would give up his freedom for security is unworthy of neither. Either? I used the word wrong? Thank you. Unworthy, though, you see, that doesn't really mean undeserving. It just means it can't happen. So we can look sometimes very closely at what are we living for? What are we investing in? What are we committed to? Because those things organize how we live our life. This is about, has been about, is about, will be about clear seeing from direct experience. And in this clear seeing that may happen at times from direct experience, there's the possibility of deconstructing or debunking false certainties. Because when that conditioning is strong enough, it creates a notion of certainty. This is how, there's certainty there, this is how I will be successful, or I will be secure, or I will be happy, or I will be fulfilled. Now, what's very difficult about this at times for the mind is that this debunking or this deconstruction is not about generating yet another kind of understanding in our minds. And this is very difficult, and this can be upsetting, it can be troubling. It's as if something is getting peeled off, but what's it being replaced with? Once the apparent sense of individuality, an individual person, is taken on, then apparent separation arises, and then there's an outcome chain that follows, as much as the cart follows the horse, and it goes like this. Concept perception of time, journey, meaning, purpose, free will, choice, action, consequence. Notice the investment that the mind can have in what these words point at. Time. There's a journey. There's a meaning and a purpose. There's free will. There's choice. There's actions that bring consequences. All of that I just said are ideas. They're ideas that can be so entranced into us, so to speak, that we perceive, believe, and act as if all of that is true, as if all of that is the way life is. And all of that is predicated on that initial point of the assumption that I am an individual person. And therefore, I am positioned in time and space, and that I'm on a journey, and the journey has meaning, purpose. And the way that I'm going to find out or achieve what that meaning and purpose is through my free will, which will give me choice, which will bring actions, and hopefully the consequences that I want or results. And all it takes is an instant, a second, a moment in these moments together to see that what is happening is being chosen by no one. That is just an unfolding. And there's a crack in the veneer there. There's a crack that can emerge in this chain or outcome chain of belief. An uncertainty arises into that field of what I'm calling false certainties. Now, some people at that point just turn right back and they get back in the driver's seat as best they can, buckle up, hold the wheel lightly, hopefully not too tight, and drive, baby, drive. I'm at risk of getting political right now. I'm holding back. All right, I'll go there. Drive, baby, drive could mean drill, baby, drill. Thinking creates time, and time creates thinking. While thinking, I maintain my illusory sense of self-identity and separation. I think, therefore I continue. My thinking in time grasps and divides, continuously producing ideas of progress towards satisfaction or calamity. It disturbs and speaks of order, and makes promises and speaks of destruction. All this my thinking does. My thinking, time, mind, moves back and forth over a sea of memories and projections from a place I call myself. No amount of thinking will tell me what I am, but insight can take me to the river's edge. Stillness is not brought about by not thinking. Stillness is absolutely beyond the presence or absence of thought. I cannot make myself still. But when that which appears not to be still is seen, then that seen emanates from stillness. Say that again. I cannot make myself still. But when that which appears not to be still is seen, then that seen emanates from stillness. That seen that emanates from stillness is moving stillness. When some folks get a sense of stillness in the body and stillness in the mind, then at times they don't want to move. They don't want to do any walking meditation or any of this movement stuff. They just want to hold it. Can't hold stillness. You could try. It's like trying to hold the breath. Again, here, a little bit potentially disturbing, but true. All the mind actually does in its attempts to understand things is divide things. It just divides things up with its thoughts. And it's attempting to understand. It just divides. It's not wrong. It's not bad. It's just something that it does. We understand with our mind the floor and the wall and the ceiling and the fan and the light are all different. They're all different things. Men, women, bodies, this sensation, that sensation, thinking, feeling, memory, all these things, all the mind does in attempting to understand these things is divide them. It's totally impossible to understand the nature of what you are. It's the attempts to understand what you are that fall away when clear seeing emerges. And this clear seeing, as I've been describing last night and around these days, is seen through. So you start out with the idea that you're going to look at things and try to look at them and not interfere. At some point, that looking actually becomes a seeing that begins to be actually questionable about who's seen. It's just a scene, and I'm not sure there's anybody in here who's doing it. It's just happening. And then eventually that scene actually goes through that which is being observed, or at least it seems like that. Okay. And when that scene goes through anything, that thing shows its true nature, which is insubstantial, transitory, and ephemeral. It's a disappearing act. Seeing through reveals that the perception of individuality, personal individuality, is a filter over or around what we actually are. It's impossible to understand what you are because you're already being what you are. Trying to understand who you truly are is like trying to grab air in your hands. Although what you truly are in most cases is obstructed by the mind's attempts to understand, and why is it trying to understand? Why is it trying to understand if not to find peace and happiness? Or escape, avoid suffering, and attain freedom, realize happiness. That's what it's trying to do, isn't it? These very efforts and strategies seem to create a veil over what or who you really are. The idea of freedom from suffering gets constructed in the mind when awakening or realization is presented as an idea, the mind hears about this, and this awakening or realization gets conceptualized as freedom from suffering. I am going to become free from suffering. I am going to become God-realized, enlightened. Call it whatever you will, but it's the I that's going to have it. We're exploring possibilities of just, without too much hardship, I hope, deconstructing this. There's no Zen master here whipping our backs if our posture goes down a bit. Right? Or we're eating too this way or that way. There's nobody shouting at us, except perhaps your own mind shouting at you about how to do this, how not to do this. And you better come to the sitting on time. I mean, we already have enough hardship that's been conditioned into us, even if those around us were doing the best they could or can, and I think they probably were, to treat us well. We don't need, I feel, as a race, more people in the name of our freedom smacking us. But it happens. What's very important here is that what gets constructed into the mind around this notion of freedom from suffering, realization, awakening, is that awakening or realization is apart from what is normally occurring. It's somewhere else. It's something else. It's different than this. Because this ain't it. So it's got to be something else. We're gently, hopefully, without too much hardship, playing with the possibility of deconstructing this, which simply means seeing clearly into it and potentially seeing through it. The opening, and you might say release, is into freedom from fear of suffering. So fear of suffering falls away, and hope for liberation also falls away. Because what's hope about? It's about something better that might happen in the future. In the future. Just consider that right there, the possibility of the falling away of fear of suffering. And since no one is hitting us here and dragging us over coals or beating us up, we're just sitting on chairs and cushions and benches. And all of this stuff is coming up. And people sometimes wonder, where's it all coming from? Nobody's doing anything to me. I'm not even doing anything to me. I'm being very gentle and kind and loving, I think, I hope. And all of this stuff is coming up. And you could spend a lot of time trying to figure out where it's all coming from. What's feeding it? What's its source? What's its cause? Why is this hurting? And we could run around and run around in that and attempt to understand it. Why? So that it would change? So that it would end? Because what would be the point if we could get it here? Wouldn't that mean we could stop thinking about it? Isn't that why we want to solve the problem? To get it completed, get it done, so we can move on? Funny thing is, you can't move on into freedom. You can't move from suffering to freedom. There's no bus. You can't even walk there. Okay, this is going to get a little dicey. Maybe. Meditation for many is an attempt to attain and maintain a sense of peace, a state of peace, or happiness. You call it what you will in terms of the state, but meditation for many is an attempt to attain and maintain a certain state. Harmony or happiness might be that state, could be peace. When in fact, what meditation actually is the seeing of things as they truly are. And it is state and circumstance, situation independent. Doesn't require a place like this, doesn't require a meditation cushion. It is not dependent on that. Personal story that hopefully will illustrate this. I used to really enjoy the company of this Sri Lankan monk named Bhante Gunaratana. Bhante Gunaratana started one of the first, I believe, forest monasteries. In America, it exists today, flourishing in West Virginia. I used to like Bhante. I like him a lot still. I just haven't seen him in a long time. But I liked him a lot, and I liked to learn from him. One day, I was doing walking meditation under his guidance. With his guidance, we're doing the walking meditation, and I had been busy for quite some time in my association with him trying to figure out what his teaching was. I want to get down, what's he really teaching here? You know, it's just one of the things that my mind does, is I want to get down to it. And we're doing this walking meditation, he's giving some instructions, and all of a sudden, this not really all of a sudden, but it seemed gradually, but then suddenly it was clear, that what he was actually teaching was no teaching. He was simply walking with us. And while I was trying to figure out what this was about and where we were going, it became clear with like one word, it seemed, that he said, that all we were doing was walking. Walking is walking. And I just laughed and felt very satisfied to be relieved of my search for what's the essence of this teaching. I used to go to where he lives because he had these kutis in the forest, and the meditation center was pretty rustic in those years. It's developed more now. There were some monks and nuns around and a few lay people, and some very greasy food, but it was tolerable, almost, well, barely, for me. But I went there, and it didn't start well for me on this particular occasion because my father-in-law dropped me off in the 16-valve jet black Scirocco, and he wanted to do this, so he took me there, and then he burned rubber in the driveway as he left, and Bhante and I were standing there, and that was the beginning of my individual retreat for that particular period at the Bhavana Society with Bhante. So as the practice unfolded, I would describe it now as there were three words that described my practice. One was sloppy, the other was serious, and the third was intense. Now, the serious one was kind of tucked in there in a way that I couldn't really see. There was an awareness of sloppiness that I was having a hard time controlling or managing. The intensity was I was helpless about. I was simply just being intense and couldn't help it, because I wanted things very much, like freedom. And so I'm in the kuti, I'm doing my meditation. It's very rustic, but I'm getting into it. It's in the forest, it's quiet. And for me, meditation was very much about states, and it was very much about getting into concentration. So there were very few people at the forest monastery at this time, maybe one or two others, a few, a monk and a nun, I believe, and then Bhante, just low-key, and a cook. So I come down in my mindful walking, just really with it, I think, down for the lunch. And I come in and I look around and I'm like, doesn't seem like there's a lunch prepared. A little feeling comes up. Have they forgotten about me? Not too big, not too difficult. And then this chain of cars pull in. And it must have been about 10 cars. They all pull in one after the other. And the Sri Lankan community from Washington, D.C., who revere Bhante as their priest, have come to serve him and whoever else is there. Now, I don't know this. Okay, here comes the serious problem. Okay, I'm busy being meditative, mindful, connected, present, alert, attentive, earnest. I don't know what that means, but I'm working on it. This all came up when Steve gave an instruction today about earnestness getting a little too tight and becoming serious. So things are not really going the way I'd planned. And the Sri Lankans come in and they've got all this food. They've got tons of food. And I'm lost already. I really feel like I need to eat, but my other feeling is run. I'm right in the middle of those two. And so I kind of go into the meditation hall there. There's Bhante, and there's the other monk. And these people start coming in with the food, and they're putting it out, and they're laying it out. And I just sit down, and I try to see if there's anything that I can do to get what I need, I think, without breaking my meditation. The whole situation is helpless. The Sri Lankans see me and they descend. And I mean descend. There's food coming from every angle. They're all smiling, they're laughing, and they're bringing all this food in front of me and they put it all out and around me just like they did with Bhante. And then there's these deviled eggs. The deviled eggs start appearing. Deviled eggs from the left, deviled eggs from the right, deviled eggs from up top. They're coming in like this. I don't know whether I'm actually experiencing this or I'm hallucinating. It's getting very, very overwhelming. The body's starting to shake. And then comes the third noble truth, the cessation. I look up and Bhante is chuckling, it seems from the toes all the way up through, absolutely, totally amused at this kid who's trying to get enlightened, I guess, and doesn't know how to just receive the generosity of deviled eggs. It was an amazing learning or teaching that came flying in, unwanted, unexpected. Took a while to calm down. I did eat as much as I could, and then said, no thank you, no thank you, no thank you, about 50 times, and I got out of there. Seriousness, sincerity, earnestness are three different words. They mean three different things. Meditation has the power, when it's operating, of seeing through layers of confusion and distorted perception. A better me, the belief in being a person who can improve and the fixation on the notion that if this person is not here, then that will be the end of everything. Fear of annihilation, fear of emptiness, until it's clear what emptiness is, there can't be any fullness. There can't be fullness until there's emptiness, until things open out. And emptiness simply means openness. How can we realize what fullness is? If you're trying to fill yourself up with experiences and there's confusion and distortions in there and trying to put things on top and be satisfied and happy and successful, what are you doing? That was me at the Bhavana Society. Thank goodness there's help that can come when you least expect it sometimes. The sense of me as and in this body-mind process has been misperceived as the most precious and cherished thing. This conditions fear of death. What is so profound is to truly find out that what is being cherished is simply a concept or an idea. Something absolutely insubstantial. Isn't that interesting? The fear of loss of control, loss of perceived security, loss of what one wants or has as one's own, or so it seems, loss of me, actually makes awakening and realization appear scary and foreboding. Because awakening realization reveals there is no you, there is no me, there is no I. Actually, that which appears to the conditioned mind as scary and foreboding, it's exactly the opposite. Awakening from the dream of separation is the safest game in town. It's the only place that true safety exists. It's the only place that true success exists. It's the only place where fulfillment and happiness truly exist. What continually produces a sense of vulnerability and unrest for humans, and this vulnerability and unrest oscillates to relative harmony and peace. What generates this is living in and through the belief that you have to negotiate your survival. You have to negotiate it through working to stay alive, attempting to be happy and successful, while the amazing truth is that life is here, it's open, it's now, and it's waiting for you just as it is. This life that's open and available and here for you now is what you really are. But it can only come forth when there's a release from waiting for things to change, get better, stop being unpleasant, or be different. If you're waiting for those things, that's your experience. When it's clearly seen that postponing your true appointment with life, as Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, postponing your true appointment, that your true appointment is actually life as it's unfolding, and that what truly makes for discontentment and unhappiness is this postponement, this holding back. When this is seen spontaneously, it becomes clear what contentment and happiness really is. What is contentment and happiness? It's the end of waiting. But awakening, as it's conceptualized, and even as it begins to occur, can threaten the defended pseudo-secure existence as I have set it up. Now, true openness, innocence, acceptance, trust, and wisdom are qualities of the nature of what you are. They're not things or activities that you do, but rather expressions of what you already are. That's what gets uncovered. That's what is liberated to come forth when ignorance dissipates. And again, what is misconceived here is the idea that awakening is a gain, that you're gaining something. No, you're not gaining something. Awakening is rather the loss of something believed in. Something that appeared to be real and true, but never was. And what is that? The sense that you are one thing and everything else is out there or not you is the appearance in the conditioned mind. And this is the perception that is believed in that propels the spiritual or religious quest. Now notice that this is just a view. That there's a you sitting here and that there's other things out there. That's a view. Just see that. That's a view. That's a perception. And then what notices this view? What notices this view or perception? Or if you like the method of what's called self-inquiry, to whom or to what does this view occur? And the answer is space. The answer is no answer. The answer is just a aha. The answer is a smile. The answer is the recognition. It's a wisdom response. It's not an understanding that's in the brain. It's the brain going, that's the answer. Can't see things as they actually are until there is leaving what appears just as it is. Okay? Two instructions for this retreat that could stay with you as long as they need to. First, simple, relax into the stillness. Relax into the stillness whether the body's moving, whether the body's sitting. Relax into the stillness whether the body's eating, body's lying down, body's reading, body's talking. Relax into the stillness. After a while, you don't have to practice relaxing into the stillness. Relaxing into the stillness happens by itself. After a while, there isn't even relaxing into the stillness. There's just stillness. Second instruction. Very simply said, not so easy. Leaving what appears just as it is. Consider that in terms of what has arisen in the experience today and yesterday. Consider leaving all of that as it is, just as it appears, no matter what it is. Leaving what appears just as it is opens the stillness and the silence. They come spontaneously. A woman once was earnest, and she wanted meditation instructions. She approached the sage Milarepa. Milarepa's practice was very deep. You can study his life. Just Google him. You can find him all over the internet. Milarepa's practice was very deep, very intense. Clarity that he brought forth was amazing, the illumination that he brought into the world. Some students once asked him, how did you come to this clarity? How did you come to this illumination? Instead of using words to answer the question, he lifted up one side and showed the cheek of his leathery buttocks and pointed right there. There's your answer. Figure that one out. So she asked him for instructions in meditation, and here's what he said. Oh, by the way, I need to add, when this came into my life, I jumped off my much less leathery buttocks, and I went straight to the teacher who gave this teaching, and I said, please, can I have that teaching, and I want it now, I said, kind of like that. And then I felt ashamed that I was so kind of impulsive. She said, sure. She wrote it down for me. And she came and gave it to me. So Milarepa said to the woman who asked for meditation instructions, look at the sky without increasing it nor decreasing it. Look at the mountains without moving away from them nor holding on to them. Look at the sea without getting lost on the surface nor in the depth of it. And then look at the mind without altering it in any way. That's what it means to leave what appears as it is. The easiest, you might say, place for most folks to actually experience that teaching is at the sense doors and in the breath. Even if from the very first moment of our time together, I invited us all to simply just listen to the sounds, just listen to the sound of silence. Don't go into the body, don't go into the breathing. All this stuff that's been moving and coming up would still come up. Guarantee you. If you really want peace, you must learn to not disturb the peace. What we are cultivating, actually what we are and what's being cultivated from what we are, is what's called prajna. Prajna is heart wisdom. One of the most revered teachings in all of the schools of Buddhism is the Heart Sutra, the Prajna Paramita Sutra. It's the sutra of the perfection of heart wisdom. All the schools of Buddhism honor this teaching. It's recited in monasteries, meditation centers regularly. What we are cultivating is felt sense wisdom. This wisdom, this aliveness comes right up through, within and through the objects that are occurring. It's in the objects that are occurring, that prajna, that wisdom, that heart wisdom. What it is love and innocence, energetically. It's love and innocence. And it's intimacy, where it's not you being intimate with things, but intimacy is all there is. The completeness and the wholeness of life is intimacy being itself. Another experience, because we have experiences sometimes that we think of and we believe and we remember as intimate experiences. And actually the truth is all there is intimacy. All the time. Anyways, another place I used to love to go was over in England. There's a meditation center called Gaia House. A very rustic, old building. There was one wall in the house that was from the 1500s. I used to go and look at that wall, and I liked to put my hand on it when I was outside. And I used to love to go there. I loved to meditate there and eat the iceberg lettuce, which was all they usually had for salads. It was okay. Iceberg lettuce, maybe a little carrot if you were lucky. Quite frugal in a sense. It was fine. We have so much more than we need in many moments. Finished a period of meditation. Very happy. Very enjoying just being there. And the way the floor moved in the second story. There was no like levelness to the floor. The building was so old the floor went like this. Felt like you were out in the water as you walked down the floor. For some reason, I don't know why, I went down the back staircase, ended up in the kitchen. There were two women who I learned later were Portuguese. They knew no English. They had two stainless steel, big stainless steel mixing bowls. And they were struggling with these mixing bowls to try to get them apart. They were stuck together, seemingly putting a lot of effort into this without any thought. There was no thought. Just walked up together spontaneously. They stopped struggling. Their hands rested. My hands rested with their hands. Our eyes met and the bowls fell apart. It's a little bit like the peanut butter jar after you banged it enough. It just opens. But for some reason, it felt more intimate than that. In the Tao, it's said, the Tao does nothing, and yet nothing is left undone. Being is the Tao. The Dharma is the Tao. This body-mind process is the Tao, even when it's not being seen clearly. Prajna, the heart wisdom that comes right up through whatever the objects of experience are. Self-conscious, Self-conscious human beings, attempting to find comfort and peace in pleasure and avoid pain. Helpless as we are when we're in that human beingness of attempting to have pleasure and avoid pain. Hidden inside that swinging, that pleasure-pain principle, as Freud called it, there's a looking for wholeness or completeness. The blindness is it's looking where there's the pleasant feeling. The irony is that there is only wholeness and completeness. It's already what is. The wisdom of the heart reveals life in its completeness and wholeness, its openness, its oneness, and that's what we are already, no matter what we've thought or believed. So then the satisfaction piece, looking for satisfaction, the different ways we look for satisfaction, looking on the outside, securing the outside, succeeding in the outside. As that proves itself inadequate, yes, inadequate to bring satisfaction. Now I'm going to go inside. I'm looking on the inside. I'm using religion as my guide. I'm using spirituality. I'm using meditation. I'm using therapy. I'm trying to find the satisfaction. This looking for the satisfaction can only arise once the sense of separation and the desire for true home from that sense of separation arises. And separation will continue as long as there are thoughts and beliefs that you or I am a certain thing, separate from other things. Always tucked into, inside the feeling of separation, is the idea that effort will bring results. Again, very strongly conditioned into some of us, effort will bring results. And therefore, we translate that right away. Even if we're told to just relax, let things be themselves, we're still subtly and unconsciously at times efforting to bring results. And we hear the teaching on right effort from the Buddha. We hear the teaching on right effort and all the words about it, and eventually that right effort is conceptualized as no effort, and we don't know what it means. The mind doesn't know what it means. Because in this effort will bring results, there's always some kind of list, short or long, of how to do it. Something to attain, something to achieve, something to wait for. It's the gold pot at the end of the rainbow. I remember this as a child. Whenever there was a rainbow and I heard the story about the golden pot, I always kept trying to find the golden pot at the end of the rainbow. I'd look, where's the gold pot? Where's the end of the rainbow? Little did I know, I was looking at the transparency, the impermanence of life, because I couldn't find. Not only could I not clearly find the end of the rainbow, but there was no gold pot. My friends, the goal pot is the rainbow. The goal pot is what's happening. This is it. In the film projector, there is light, a constant light. And then the film, which is your life story, running through the projector. It runs through with all the characters and events on it, and at the end it falls out, and it's no more. And then there's only light, simply being as light. When there is no need to escape suffering nor indulge experiences, then the spacious, uncontracted nature of being in whatever is happening arises spontaneously. And pleasantness is simply a byproduct. Experientially, it becomes clear that whatever is happening for the first time, the only time, and that it's impossible for anything other than what is happening to be occurring at any instant. That things are truly just the way they are. This realization, which is a realization of intimate immediacy, is impossible to grasp, which means hold on to, and it's equally impossible to avoid. The unknown is not in opposition to the known. The unknown is where the known arises from and disappears into. Awareness is unknown. What appears in awareness appears as the known. To say the known arises out of the unknown isn't quite fair, because it suggests there's a progression in time from the known to the unknown back into the unknown. To say that who you are is beyond what can be known simply means what we are is too profound for the mind to get. You can't think your way to the answer. But inquiry, meditation can take you to the cliff's edge, the river's edge, and open the space, which is the prajna, which is the heart wisdom of recognition or resonance with the answer that your mind is trying to find. Seeing this clearly, that you cannot understand or know what you are. Seeing this clearly can release the obsession, and it is an obsession, with thinking about problems and solutions. But more importantly, that's pretty important, but more importantly, seeing this clearly can release and liberate the habit of identifying yourself as anything particular. See that. The liberation of the habit, tendency to identify yourself as anything particular. And if there's no identification with anything particular, who are you? Just as water and its quality of being moist are contained in an inseparable wholeness, so too awareness and its qualities, which is the phenomena of experience. These are the qualities of awareness, the phenomena of experience, what's actually happening, are non-dual and inseparable. So too, also, everything that arises is not just whole unto itself, but it is open as itself and primordially free immediately as soon as it arises. It is already free as itself. awareness is indivisible from that which it is aware of. Direct, unmediated experience confirms this beyond doubt. Any and all beliefs, assumptions, and conceptions are the only things that suggest otherwise. Now here's the term. And yet, any and all beliefs, assumptions, interpretations, and concepts also arise whole unto themselves and are open, free, and innocent immediately upon arising. In illumination, in awakening, description, yeah, belief, assumption, conception, interpretation loses its ability to represent accurately any experience. Portray it, describe it, capsulize it, know it. And it's then that these conceptions, assumptions, beliefs, interpretations can no longer condition any suffering, nor their absence in any way add to the unconditioned nature of freedom. Longchenpa, 12th century, Dzogchen master. He said, the state of spaciousness, the true nature of being, is without boundaries and is non-dual. It does not come into being and cannot be destroyed. It neither endures nor decays, and neither comes nor goes. Within this space, the entire variety of phenomena appear distinctly, yet when they manifest, they are naturally devoid of complexity. That's a very interesting teaching. The true nature of being as spaciousness, without boundaries, non-dual, does not come into being. The true nature of being does not come into being. Cannot be destroyed. Does not decay nor endure. Does not come and go. Is the mind slightly vulnerable to confusion? He's speaking right into the unconditioned. The unconditioned is indescribable, but the words here are attempting to point. Let's sit for a few minutes.